Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Con men rely on one thing. Shame over having been taken will prevent their victims from reporting the crime. But Frank Norfleet was not a man to go quietly. He was a prosperous Texas rancher who, in 1919, lost everything in a stock swindle, and he decided that he was going to get even. Over a four-year period, he traveled the country, hunting down the men who had cheated him, eventually sending them to jail and becoming famous in the process. In this hour of Focus, we will get the story of Frank Norfleet and his reverse con, and that is the subject, along with a review of the big con in American history. That is the subject of a recent book that we'll be talking about. The title of the book is The Mark Inside, the subtitle A Perfect Swindle, A Cunning Revenge, and A Small History of the Big Con. Knopf is the publisher of the book, and the author is Amy Reading. She's joining us this morning by telephone. She is an historian by her academic training. She has a PhD in American Studies from Yale, and she's joining us by phone to talk about the book. Questions and comments are welcome. People like to get involved in the conversation. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. At any point here, you can call in if you have questions. Also, email is possible as well. You want to send us an email, the address is will-talk@illinois.edu. And Ms. Reading, hello.
Hello.
It's a great story. How did you come upon this story?
I came upon it while I was researching my dissertation in American Studies. The dissertation is very, very boring, but there was an exciting chapter in it, which is a chapter on autobiographies by swindlers. Sometime a coincident with the era of the big con, which is the 19-teens and 1920s, swindlers started writing their autobiographies to spill the secrets of the trade and tell people how the con was worked, which was, of course, just another way for them to earn a buck by selling a book. So I was writing about these autobiographies when I came across Norfleet's autobiography. Norfleet was the sucker who squealed, the sucker who got even with his swindlers. And he also, after going on this series of adventures, figured out another way to make money from his story, which was to write it all down as an autobiography, and that was one of the many ways, actually, that he became famous in his own era, but then subsequently forgotten, and so it was rereading his autobiography that brought the story all back.
Well, that's what makes this a great story, and that is, yes, indeed, there have been times when people who were celebrated con men, at least they were famous, they were well known, and they did talk about what happened to them and what they did, but people who were the victims, they certainly didn't. The idea that someone would admit to having been taken, that's the kind of thing that just didn't happen. And as I suggest in my introduction, that's something that people who are in the con game take advantage of.
Yes, but there's a lot to say about that. First of all, there are really two reasons why a victim would not say anything. And the first and probably the main reason, as you point out, is shame. I mean, you can't go back to your small town and admit to everyone that you've been taken for everything and then hope to do business with anyone else in your small town ever again. You'll be revealed as foolish and a bad businessman, and you just can't afford that kind of ignominy, I suppose. But there's another reason, which is that in the course of the big con, which is very cleverly designed, the mark is made to believe that he is engaging in something slightly shady himself. Mm. So even if he wanted to rat out his con men, he believes he can't because he himself would be implicated and open to prosecution. And so he's tied into the con with this little hook that often prevented him from saying anything, even if he could have borne the shame. But then another thing to say about all of that is that it was a truism of the time, and you know, in the time, as we're saying, the big con was discussed at great length in newspapers and magazine articles, and it was something that was very well known, a very standard part of popular culture at the time. And one of the truisms of that discussion, that culture-wide discourse, is this idea that the sucker never squeals, and it was a point of pride among con men that they had designed this so well. But it wasn't true. It wasn't true at all. It was something that was part of the mythology of the Big Con. But I found, in the course of researching Norfleet's story, that there were lots of suckers who squealed, and they would tell their stories to police officers and district attorneys. They would tell their stories to newspaper reporters in the hopes that publicity would bring their men to justice or maybe even get some of their money back. The real truth is that even if a sucker squealed, they wouldn't necessarily get any kind of satisfaction or justice or certainly no money back because the people that they squealed to were all bought off. And that's the real story, is that that there was another layer of protection even behind this idea of the Marx shame.
That the people who were pulling off the cons had arrangements made with law enforcement and with people in authority to give them protection if indeed the Marx did go to them and say, look, this terrible thing happened to me and you got to do something about it.
Absolutely. They were completely bought off, and there was a whole ritual in place in these small towns and cities where con men operated for what the, you know, city detectives should do if a mark comes to them. And, you know, for instance, okay, we'll take the sucker and we'll walk him around the streets and ask him to identify the offices and the places that where he had been conned. But, you know, the city detective would know very well where those places were, so he would take the mark to a different part of town, get the mark very disoriented and lost, and the mark would be unable to really give any kind of evidence. And so then the detective would throw up his hands. I'm sorry, sir, we can't help you. Why don't you go back home to your small town, and we'll let you know if we've got any leads, which, of course, they never did.
Mm-hmm. And here we're talking about, when you talk about the Big Con, we're talking about something that is very elaborate, will involve a team, a number of individuals, a very complicated way of ensnaring the victim. And truly, if people want to think about what it is we're talking about, we are talking about something that has been dramatized. And if you think about The Sting, for example, that's what it is we're talking about here.
Exactly. The Sting is the classic movie that is itself drawn from some of these swindler autobiographies that I've been mentioning. And it is, it depicts a con that happens over sometimes as long as 2 or 3 weeks. It involves a team of swindlers. In Norfleet's case, it was 5 main actors, sometimes dozens of extras, sets, costumes, props. It's extremely elaborate, and part of and that's one of the reasons why the con works, is because no one would ever imagine that there was this elaborate structure in place just for them, that everything that they're seeing has been designed to take their money. But then in addition to the sets and the people, there's also a script that has been very well honed, and there's a story that the mark is told for, that they enter into, and the mark has lines too, and just because he doesn't know them doesn't mean he's not going to utter them at the right time, because the script has been so designed. So in The Sting, the story that the mark is told is about horse racing, and if you remember the movie, that Studs Lonigan, I believe is the mark's name, believes he's betting money at a racetrack that has been fixed in his favor. In Norfleet's case, the story is very similar, but it's a stock market exchange rather than a racetrack. So you can modify the story a bit, but the basic structure is identical across all of these cons that took, you know, tens of thousands of dollars at a time from their victims.
Yeah, that's in this particular case. He bumps into some people. He thinks he just bumps into them, and they say, "Well, he's a fine fellow and all." And in fact, they say, "Look, you know, we're privy to some inside information here, and if you give us some money, we can invest that in some stock, and this is a sure thing. And there's no way in which you can lose. In fact, you can we can win big time here." And it's you lay it on the book, and it's really pretty complicated. But the bottom line is that, yes, they persuade him, Mr. Norfleet, to give them the money, this gang of guys led by a man named Joe Fury, to give them what was for the time a very substantial amount of money. And they made off with this money, and that was that.
Yes, there's one part of what your description, which was otherwise excellent, that I would like to correct, which is important because it's counterintuitive. They never asked him for his money. He didn't actually put money up in this stock market. He wasn't speculating or betting or gambling his own money. And I think that's really interesting, and that was one of the surprises to me when I began to research all this. They gave him money to speculate and swindle, and he then grew a fortune on this fake stock exchange by betting with their inside tips. But at this point, he had no money in, there's no risk to him, and it was a sort of a lark. And I think that's kind of interesting because anyone might have acted very differently if they had been asked to put up their own money. The con comes a little bit later. Like you say, it's extremely elaborate. The actual stealing of the money comes at the very, very end when Norfleet had earned or gambled or won this giant pot of money on this fake exchange, and in order to take it out of the exchange, he had to bring some of his own money to the exchange to kind of ransom it, and it's very complicated why he had to do that. But it's just this little filigree, this just example of this little design element in the script that makes all the difference in the world.
Yeah, and that's the part you'd think that if going through all of this and you thought that you'd made this money and then you were going to collect your profits, and then at the very end the people said, well, just one thing here, we just need to make sure that you actually have some money so that you could have covered this bet if you were betting your own money. So we just need to see your money. And so what he does is he brings the money, he gives it to them, and then they disappear with the money. And that somehow seems a little, why at that point would you not say, well, what do you mean you want to see my money? I'm not going to give you my money. You give me my money that I have made off this deal.
Well, it seems to the mark at that moment like a mere bureaucratic detail. So what actually happened was the exchange secretary said, oh, wait, now that you've earned all this money, I see that you actually are not a member of this particular local exchange, and you weren't legitimately speculating. And in order to have speculated this money, you would have had to put down a margin. You would have had to put down some of your own money as a deposit. And we'll let you have this money, which we're going to store in our bank vault, if you can now retroactively put down that margin. And so it seems absolutely harmless. It's not spending the money. It's literally just displaying it. And the money that the mark thinks he's about to win, he has held that in his hands, a banded stack of many, many, many thousands of dollars. It is real, it is tangible, and there's a plausible story for why it's his. He has absolutely no reason to suspect it. And it's very hard, I think, when, you know, you and I, we're not in the midst of the con. We haven't had it working on us for the past 2 weeks. So it's a little bit hard to understand the magic that has wrought on the Mark's psychology. But there is something about the tangibleness, the nearness of that fortune, and the way it's about to change the Mark's life that makes him foolish, and that makes him take a bunch of money out of his account and hand it over to a perfect stranger.
And I suppose the thing is, that people, as you explained, that people need to understand that the reason you call it a con game is that what you do, if you're the con artist, that what you're doing is you're gaining the confidence. That's what the con part is there, the confidence of the mark. Mm-hmm. And that you do that step by step, slowly, over a period of time, so that then the idea is that the mark should get to the point where whatever it is you tell them, they believe you. They have confidence in the fact that you are who you say you are and that you're going to do what you say you're going to do.
Yes, so these con men are, to use another con word, consummate actors. Mm. They're very charming, magnetic personalities. They're very good at playing their role because they've played it hundreds of times. It's, you know, the role that they know best, as, you know, if they're playing the stockbroker or the exchange secretary. And they've reeled the mark in very gradually. They cannot ever seem to be coming on too strong, to offer the mark something for nothing, to ask the mark for his money. It has to be far more gradual, and so that's part of the script as well, is building confidence by doing a bunch of other steps in the game that might seem unnecessary or might seem like filler, but are actually part of getting the mark's confidence. And I mean things like pretending to go in on the mark on a completely separate business deal, simply to make them seem like, you know, hail fellows, heartily met, you know, like, you know, new friends that are equals and that are also businessmen looking for the main chance, just like the mark. So it happens gradually, and it's it's, again, it's kind of like magic, or like a machine that takes up the mark and pulls him into this process without him knowing.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Amy Reading, and she is the author of the book, The Mark Inside. It's published by Knopf, and it tells the story of this man and his experiences, this man, Frank Norfleet, who was the victim of this con and then struck back. And also, in a larger sense, it's also about the big con, a little bit of the history of the big con and some of the big con artists in American history. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And we have an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, we now have the story. We have the story of what happened to Frank Norfleet, which is told to us by way of his memoir by Frank Norfleet. So at some point we can talk a little bit about how we try to assess the story that he tells us, because it's a really good story. So what happens is that he's the victim of this con, and he decides that he's not going to take this lying down. He goes home. He says to his wife, look, you're going to have to run the ranch here because I'm going out after these guys. He had no experience in law enforcement. He had never done a private investigator, but he was really angry. Mm-hmm. And so he decided he was going to take out after this guy. And of course, as I say, we know all of this because Norfleet wrote a book about it later. What do you think it was that even gave him the confidence that out of the whole United States, and he didn't know where these guys were, that he would even be able to figure out where they were?
You know, that's a big mystery about this whole story. So he was from Hale Center, Texas, which is in the Panhandle. He was swindled in Dallas and Fort Worth. But then he went home after he was swindled, and he had no idea where his con men went after that. And he, in fact, was pretty certain that they weren't in Dallas or Fort Worth, the only places where he had ever encountered them. So even just the decision to go after them is, you know, unusual, to say the least. And then to just decide to just go out on the road. In his case, it was the railroad in 1920, it's so improbable that it would work that it's hard to imagine anyone being foolish enough to just try it. So I think this part of the story just has to come down to the wonderful genius of J. Frank Norfleet, and that he was a character, and he had a lot of rage, but he also had just this really stubborn sense of justice that had been thwarted, and he was not going to take that anymore. And I think that really just made him creative. And he decided to start his search in California, but he had no real good reason for thinking that. Later on, he would realize that it was a good decision because, in fact, swindlers will often be in warmer weather in the winter months. But, you know, at the time, he didn't know that there was any kind of pattern to this very secretive underworld subculture. He had no idea. He was soon to learn all of this, but at the beginning, it was just this kind of leap of faith, and luckily for him, he has some successes early on so that he was affirmed in his decision to go on this quest. But initially, it was just kind of madcap or quixotic or almost crazy.
Yeah. Well, he tells the story about how he has this idea, and again, it's sort of complicated. If people want to read the full story, they should look at the book. But he has this idea, well, maybe they're hiding out in California. Mm-hmm. So he gets on a train in Texas, and he goes to California, and he rides, and he goes to the end of the line, which happens to be San Bernardino. Mm-hmm. So he gets off the train in San Bernardino. He doesn't really know, you know, what to do, but he decides, well, I guess I'll go and talk to the sheriff. So he goes down to the sheriff's office and unburdens himself of his story, tells him about what happened to him, tells him that there was this gang of guys that took him for his money, and he's looking for these guys. And the sheriff says to them, well, my friend, you're in luck. Come here, come with me. And he takes them to where the cells are, and lo and behold, sitting there in jail are two of the five guys that Frank Norfleet is looking for. Now, you might say that is just the most unbelievable stroke of luck anybody has ever had, but that's the story that he tells.
And it is true, as much as I was able to verify in terms of the dates. I mean, those men were apprehended in San Bernardino, California, just around Christmas time, 1919, which is just a few weeks after he was swindled in the in late November, beginning of December, 1919. So it is on one level, just an incredible stroke of luck. Two of his five men, he found them within a few hours of stepping off the train, which was itself a few hours after deciding to go on this quest. So somehow out of this entire giant country, he landed on them. So it's true, but it also might be just a partial truth. There might be more to his story of how this all happened than he tells us in his autobiography. And there's certainly far more amazing coincidences that happen after that. And he does manage to find his men, and it takes a while, but there's lots and lots of instances where a modern-day reader who's used to a much bigger country with many hiding spots is really just shaking her head going, how could this have happened even back then? And I think the answer is that there are things that he did that he didn't want to report in his autobiography. I think he may have used some unorthodox or maybe even unethical or illegal methods to get his men. I'm nearly certain that he probably bribed people or to get information or to report on the activities of various people. And he, you know, who knows? Who knows what else he might have done? But certainly his version of the tale needs to be read with a grain of salt. And then having said that, I would hasten to say, you know, just as quickly, and yet most of it is true and verifiable in court records and newspaper reports and, you know, just the flat-out facts of the case are he did get those guys, and he did bring them to justice. He had those two men that were captured in San Bernardino extradited back to Texas. He testified against them, and they went to jail. He got them.
Yeah, and he's quite the character, this man Frank Norfleet, and he did indeed write this book, and he went on and gave speeches and toured around the country, and he even went as far as to start to try to make a movie about himself. So he definitely made a name for himself as being this crusader against the con man, and I'm sure probably played up the image as being one of the few people, at least, who ever decided, I'm going to get even, and it was actually successful.
Yes, and part of the reason why we can verify his story so many years after the fact is because he became famous pretty quickly on. Newspapers began to follow his quest, and the fact that he was succeeding was just unbelievable. And he absolutely took advantage of that publicity. He was very modern in that sense. He knew exactly what to do when the spotlight was turned on him. He was this colorful guy. You know, he had just he played up the cornpone Texan whenever he felt like he needed to. Of course, he wasn't, you know, dumb by any means. He was very smart, but he could ham it up as this, you know, country rancher, and the newspapers loved him, and they loved that he was succeeding at getting these bad guys in jail, and he was doing it without help from the officials, and it was this, you know, kind of do-it-yourself vigilante quest that was succeeding. So he did enter into the public record pretty quickly. So like I say, we can verify his story, but then also he entered into the culture pretty quickly, and people began to recognize him. They began to approach him and ask him for help getting their swindlers. And even his name became synonymous with going after someone who's gotten you. So it would be, you know, there would be newspaper articles about other people that had gotten their, you know, robbers, or he wasn't even necessarily specific to swindling, but that would be called, you know, pulling a Norfleet or doing a Norfleet. So it wasn't a very popular phrase, but people recognized that what he was doing was unique and very valuable, and it was performing a kind of corrective on the mythology of the con artists at the time. They weren't all powerful, and that, you know, there was some bit of weakness in their armor, and that somebody like Norfleet could actually do what he set out to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is a great story, and you could easily imagine this being a movie. Even today, probably, you could easily imagine this being a movie. And the idea of someone taking this misfortune and reversing it and turning it into a fortune, you can understand that as well, and you would even have to admire that a little bit. At the same time, though, if you think about what it was that he might have done and things that he might have done he might not have talked about or who wouldn't have put in the book, then it gets into some interesting questions about, where is the line between him and them, and where is the line between the mark and the con man, and did he, in fact, cross the line in his search for revenge and justice?
I think he definitely blurred that line, and I think he had to in order to succeed. So he started off life, you know, he was 54 when he was swindled, and for, you know, for most of his life he was this quintessential Texas panhandle rancher with what he would call a cowboy justice, where he's going to do business with you with a handshake and treat you as an honest, upright citizen, and you're going to do the same to him. But the second that that's violated, he gets to kill you, basically. So it's an absolute black right or wrong sense of justice, and that's why he was so outraged when the swindlers took him for everything he had, because they did not play by that cowboy justice. So, but over time, as he went after his swindlers, that moral code really became a lot grayer, and it had to, because in order to catch his swindlers, what he did was go in disguise himself. He made a decision very early on not to catch his swindlers at the point of his gun and not to kill them like his code dictated that he could. He decided he was going to bring them to justice in the American courts of law, which meant that he needed to catch them but not kill them. And in order to catch them, he needed to enter into the con again as a mark again, but this time as a knowing one, as someone who was in disguise. If they knew it was Norfleet, they would never have tolerated that, but he needed to disguise himself over and over again to out-con the con men and to learn their game, learn their script even better than them, so that he could penetrate their subculture and be swept into the con, not necessarily by his con men, but by other people in this, you know, underground fraternity, in order to gather clues against his men. So in doing that, I think he became a lot more like the con men, and he also became someone who was far more comfortable acting and changing his personality to suit the moment, so that when it came time to tell his story to the culture at large, he was absolutely able to be a showman in the same way that a con man is. He could be a charmer, and he could market himself in the same way that a confidence man does. And he didn't used to have that ability. I think it was his quest that sort of taught him that and gave him the idea of marketing his story as a way to wreak a second kind of revenge against the con men. You know, the first kind would be to get them in jail, and the second version of revenge would be to tell his version of the con story, which itself became a kind of spiel, a kind of script that he told over and over again. Like you say, he was he tried to make a silent movie of himself, starring himself, produced by himself. He also was on radio programs, and he went on a lecture tour where he was telling his story over and over again, and the tour itself traced the pathways that he had taken on his crisscrossing of the country in order to get the con men. So literally he repeated himself over and over and over again. And I think he became absolutely like the con men. And you know what? It worked for him. He told his story his entire life, and he lived until he was into his hundreds.
Yeah, he apparently died at the ripe old age of 102 after having had this second career as being the man who beat the con man.
Yes, and he never really recouped the money he lost. He lost an incredible amount of money. He never even really went back to ranching, although he did move back to the Texas Panhandle. And he told his story, and, you know, if you look back in the newspaper archives in Texas in the time, like, you know, every 8 or 10 years, there's another feature article about Norfleet and the time that he caught those dastardly con men. And it was something that was told all his life, and it was told at every birthday honoring this, you know, classic Texas pioneer. So it became his life story, even though it never made him the fortune that he lost.
Yeah. Our guest in this hour of focus is Amy Reading, and we're talking about the story that you will find in her book, The Mark Inside, A Perfect Swindle, A Cunning Revenge, and A Small History of the Big Con. It's published by Knopf, out now. We'll talk some more after a very short break. This is Focus.
WILL programs are made possible by Strawberry Fields Natural Food Store. Strawberry Fields offers natural vitamins, health and beauty products, household cleaning products, pet foods, and an in-store nutritionist to answer questions about healthy eating. Strawberry Fields on Springfield Avenue in Urbana.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. I'm glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics every week. Tomorrow and the next day, we'll be running archives. Tomorrow, you'll hear some programs that we first broadcast in March. In the first hour, Susan Cain talks about her book, Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking. We're told that to be great is to be bold, that really happy people are the most sociable, but she makes this argument that introverts, they have a function in the world, and there's nothing wrong with being quiet person. That'll be in the first part of the show. Then hour two, this is an interview I did with Eric Kleinenberg. He's professor of sociology at New York University, and his book is titled Going Solo, which is about the increasing trend of people living alone. So these two things kind of go hand in hand. Today, one of every seven adults in the United States lives alone. So that's what you'll hear tomorrow. Oh, and also in the second hour today, we will have a live show. We'll be taking your questions on children's health, and our guest will be pediatrician Dr. Malcolm Hill. We're here weekday mornings, 10 to noon, 10 different topics every week. We always welcome your questions and your comments. You can check the schedule by going to our website. That's willill.illinois.edu. There are also many past programs there that you can listen to. In this hour focus, we're talking with Amy Reading. Her new book is The Mark Inside, and it's published by Knopf. It's just recently out. Questions and comments are certainly welcome, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, so if it would be a long-distance call, you can use that number. That's 800-222-9455. And you can also send us an email if you would like. That's will-talk at illinois.edu. There's something here I think that I'm sure that there are have always been confidence men operating in Europe and in other countries. So that's not something that's distinctly American. But I don't know. Something about this story strikes me as being very American.
Yes, I think it's very American, and we don't have to claim that it's exclusively American in order to put that adjective on it. I think really the fascination and the prevalence of con men is a phenomenon of any market culture, any culture where financial transactions happen on the basis of trust. That can very easily be perverted by con men. But in this country in particular, the entire country is a self-made country, and we venerate the self-made man, while the con man is just a further turn of the screw of that mythology, someone that not just invented himself, but you know, really made himself up from nowhere and is faking it. And so the con man, I think, is extremely American and has grown up with our economic development as the 19th and early 20th century saw really the building up of our nation. And in my book, I argued not only that the con man is part of that, but that swindlers, actual historical swindlers, and not just the mythology or the mythic figure, but actual swindlers were drivers of that economic development in a lot of ways, that we owe far more to swindlers than we would perhaps like to admit.
Mm-hmm. This kind of thing that certainly has been dramatized before, and as we said sort of in the first part of the conversation, the thing to think of here is the sting, with a very elaborate multi-stage plot involving a lot of people, and to the point where indeed it's almost like putting on a play, all for the benefit of the one person who is the mark. Now, it's certainly we have swindlers today. You know, we have guys like Bernie Madoff, but that seems like that wasn't really quite so elaborate or quite so complicated, involved quite so many people. Do things like this still happen, or is there something about this that's strikingly 19th century in its nature?
Well, the big con is definitely a product of the early 20th century, and it evolves in very specific ways from some short cons of the 19th century. So there's a whole history to how it developed. It's not an accident that the con was structured this way in the 1920s, and it wasn't the product of one person's genius. It was this very careful evolution with a lot of people working to develop this structure and the script. But then that was adapted. I mean, you can think of it in evolutionary terms. It was adapted to its times in a very particular way, and those times are no longer with us. So now you do see that some of the era's cons persist, and if you look at Madoff, then you're looking backward to Charles Ponzi, and so that, you know, the Ponzi scheme is more viral and more adaptable to the times, but the big con really is not quite in play like it was in The Sting or like it is in Mike Norfleet's story. But what we do have instead are internet scams. Mm-hmm. And those are very, very similar, but just transposed onto a virtual world. And they play on many of the same buttons. I mean, the underlying structure is often the same. And there's always a point at which the internet scam needs to become personal, where there has to be a personal meeting between the con man and the mark. I'm thinking specifically of Nigerian 419 schemes that they do eventually get off the internet. But the internet is where our relationships are, and that, for better or for worse, is where we place our confidence.
Mm-hmm. That's it. You just mentioned in passing the name of Charles Ponzi, and I think that people will have heard about the Ponzi scheme or the pyramid scheme, which is a kind of structure that's often presented as a kind of investment where you put money in and then you get a lot more money back. And basically the idea is that the early investors are paid off by the later investors. And they're actually, what people might not know, there actually was a guy named Ponzi who came up with this idea and for whom it is named. And it seems that the problem with that is that eventually it's got to fall apart. The idea of the big con is maybe you can, if you're the con artist and you do it right, you make your big score and then you disappear. That's it. You're done. But it seems like the other case is the Ponzi scheme is bound to collapse at some point of its own weight.
Yes, so the Ponzi scheme, it will, as you put it, it will become top-heavy, right? Like, there will be more people that have been invested in this entire kind of group enterprise than the scheme can possibly pay out. And that's certainly what happened to Madoff. There came a time when, well, I mean, he was actually turned in, but he wouldn't have been able to prolong that forever. And so the difference between a Ponzi scheme and the big con is that the big con is focused on one mark at a time, and that mark is the sole focus of this team of confidence men, and it's sort of a play put on for one guy, whereas the Ponzi scheme is a group enterprise that pulls a lot of its strength and gains a lot of its confidence from the fact that you're joining in with other people who have also trusted the same investor, in this case Madoff. So you can believe the story that he's telling you because so many people before you have also believed it. So there are some definite structural differences, but the central kernel that remains the same across confidence games and that distinguishes them from any other kind of thievery is that the mark willingly hands over his money to someone he believes is acting in his best interest. Mm-hmm. And the creation of that feeling of trust is the theatrical moment, and that happens all of the time nowadays. And, you know, I would point out about Ponzi schemes that even after Ponzi was unmasked, and then even after Bernie Madoff was unmasked, the Ponzi scheme still persists. So knowing that there is this kind of structure out there, there is this mechanism to relieve people of their savings, is not enough of a barrier to keep people from entering into the con. And even since Bernie Madoff went to jail just in the past 2 years, the SEC has continued to prosecute over 200 individuals in Ponzi schemes, and the most recent that I read about was an Amish Ponzi scheme, which violates everything we know about the way the world is supposed to operate. So even knowing the story, even if you knew in the 1920s how the big con worked, maybe you read something about Norfleet, or maybe you knew someone that had been taken in the big con, that did not inoculate you from falling into it yourself, because the con men would find your particular button and draw you into their script.
Yeah, and that's, I suppose, they're also relying on the fact that people always are going to think that they're too smart to be taken.
Yes, and that is definitely helpful, that sense of superiority. But there's a definite, I would make a lot of qualifications of that, because I believe that pretty much anyone could be swindled, because anyone has a button that a con man can push to get them to, you know, open up their wallet. That button might not be the same. It might not be greed for everyone. Maybe it's maybe you're really willing to help out a stranger, and that's how I could, you know, reel you into my game. Maybe it's a your vulnerability is actually a good quality that you have, and you know, me being the swindler, I can take advantage of that. So it's not simply stupidity. It's definitely not stupidity, and it's not simply greed. It also can be, you know, all of the reasons why we should trust people, but that can be perverted to the con man's end.
Well, I guess that also suggests what the genius of the con man, or those that are really good, is that they're really good at reading people and reading the marks and figuring out, learning about them and figuring out how best to make the pitch to take advantage of their particular personalities or who they are, to just tune the offer just right so that it will work with that person.
But wouldn't you love to have that skill yourself, that ability to read people so well? That's another example of a con man taking something good and perverting it. Like, that kind of ability to read people and empathize with them so radically, we often hold that up as a positive trait, and that's something that we would especially like, you know, a politician to have or a physician. And then here, in its ultimate, most extreme form, it's in the hands of criminals who are very good at their work, both actors, you know, as actors and as, you know, they're good at relationships. They're very good at relationships, and they're very charming.
Yeah. Well, I have a couple of questions here. We have some people on the phone. I have some email here. Let me go first to our first caller who is in line. This is someone who is calling from Eureka, and line number 4 right here. Hello.
Hello. Very interesting program. You were talking just in the last minute or two about vulnerabilities and about being taken. I guess one of the things that I find in real life is I need to trust my intuition more about things or people, and sometimes we're afraid to trust that because we go through a whole rational process. But when I look back and I realize I've had some very funny feelings about people or things, and they turn out to be true. Could you comment on the role intuition might play in helping us to make better decisions?
That's a great question. I'm not so sure I have any specific psychological insights other than to say, of course we need to use our intuition, and of course we need to extend trust, or, as you say, not extend trust if you get a funny feeling. But the fact that we're all vulnerable should not mean, therefore, we shouldn't trust anyone. Because if that was the take-home message from, you know, any sort of stories of con artistry, then all of society and certainly all of commerce would grind to a halt. We do need to trust people, and sometimes it's a kind of faith that has no real basis other than our intuition that, yes, this is a situation that's on the up and up. And I think that's great. I think the chances of us being swindled are very slim, and that what we should do is simply agree or simply recognize that our society is built on relationships and interactions that are greased by trust, and that has been true all throughout American history. So I would say, you know, absolutely, we should trust our intuition, and often in retrospect, we can look back on that situation and we can then see why we've had that intuition. We can see that there was a kind of rational basis to it that wasn't available to us in the moment. But in the moment, you look into your, I don't know, your heart or your gut or your brain, and you go with it.
Another thing I find very useful is just any major decision, just delay. I mean, there are people that work on pressure, but I think delaying is always a good tactic. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's go on to another caller here. This is Urbana, here where we are, line number 1. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
You made reference a few minutes ago to the Amish Ponzi scheme that's been in the news recently.
Mm-hmm.
I know the Amish very well, and I know a bit about the circumstances of this, and the one thing that sets this apart, I mean, what the Amish Ponzi scheme shows is the importance of having regulated banking systems.
Mm-hmm.
So the Amish have long had a kind of informal systems of loaning money to each other, which has worked fairly well in most circumstances. But in the last 20 years, with more of the Amish economy being based on industry and manufacturing, they've had a surplus of cash. And the individual involved in Ohio, rather than using it for intergenerational loans to help the older generation, help the younger get started, he was investing it, he said, in T-bills, but a broker got a hold of him, and he got going on high-tech stocks in the boom years a decade ago. And when that went upside down, all of a sudden his portfolio owed more than cash he had on hand. And rather than immediately telling the people what had happened, he thought over time he could earn it back. So in contrast to someone like Madoff, who was using the money for his own purposes and living lavishly and so on, this man was simply incompetent.
Yes.
And there's no imputation that he was doing anything to further his own financial interests.
Right, and he doesn't necessarily deserve to be lumped in with the rascals that I've been discussing this hour. And there's a lot to say of interest about this case of the Amish Ponzi scheme. And I think the first thing
is a cautionary tale.
Yes,
it is a cautionary tale that, you know, everyone should pay attention when they have an opportunity to loan money to people that they know or put money with people that they know. Is that no matter how well intentioned things are, there's a risk involved.
Yes,
and
I think the counterbalance to risk, whether you're talking a traditional community based on long historical family ties like the Amish, or you know a global financial system like the rest of us have, the counterbalance to the risk involved in that situation is always transparency. And that's what I think our banking laws and any kind of regulation needs to go more toward, is disclosure, so that we have the information. And then the next step would, of course, be education, so that we have a greater proportion of financial savvy in our adult population than I think currently exists. But bad things happen when that information is hidden, and when secrets and secret deals can flourish in the back corners of the financial system.
One of the fascinating things about the Amish story is that from the perspective of the Amish community, his offense was not so much that he got upside down financially and you know, lost 30% of the money that was invested, but that when he became illiquid, he sought the advice of an attorney who encouraged him to take bankruptcy, which is a religious offense. The Amish would never do that. And so the community would rather that he not take bankruptcy and that he lay out his situation, and that, you know, they work out among themselves an equitable system to distribute the money that's left. And so he really got into trouble for using the courts, and they're trying now to get it discharged from bankruptcy and handle it themselves. But, of course, once you start down the line of bankruptcy, that's not very easy.
Right. I think what I've read about that case is always contrasts it to Madoff, of course, that being the big example in modern times of a Ponzi scheme, and the difference between those who were defrauded by Madoff and want his head on a plate versus in the Amish community, they want him out of the court system so that they can forgive him and work through his transgressions in their own way, rather than a sort of more typically American sense of revenge and justice. And that contrasts, again, quite starkly with the story that we've been discussing in my book with J. Frank Norfleet, that there are different ways of dealing with these same transactions, and it's important to recognize how much culture plays in the endings of some of these stories.
I want to thank the caller. We just have a couple of minutes left. I have an email from somebody here who was listening to the conversation and was interested in having you talk a little bit about some of the research that you did on the Norfleet story, and particularly looking at this question of knowing or suspecting that he was stretching the truth. How did you know, as you were looking at what it is he wrote, his own account of what happened to him, how did you know that, in fact, you had the real story?
Well, I have to say, first off, that I became very exhilarated by the idea that maybe this Norfleet character that I was dealing with might himself be a trickster. And that, you know, it could threaten to sink the whole project, right? If this guy is an unreliable narrator of his own life, then how can we ever figure out the history? But instead, I thought that was a great amount of fun, because dealing with him and his story, him as the, you know, the relator of his own tales, was a lot like being inside a con game, or at least in a kind of, maybe a hoax would be a better word, that there's a testing of wit and intellect that was quite fascinating. And so that definitely enhanced the project and hopefully enhances the book itself, that I lay that all bare for the reader. Again, transparency is the name of the game here, and trying to bring the reader into this game of evaluating Norfleet. And so I did need to go back into history and dig up court cases and newspaper files, for the most part, to see how much I could put dates and times and places on what he was saying. And though I make a great deal of hay out of the times that I cannot verify him, it is worth pointing out that for at least 90% or something of his story, I was able to verify it. He is telling the truth. The basic facts and the basic skeleton of his story is absolutely true. And so that, if we're really only talking about a small percentage, then we're definitely in the realm of history here rather than fiction. And so it was reading his story really closely with a kind of gamesmanship perspective that enabled me to really finger the parts in his story when when I thought maybe he wasn't telling the whole truth, when I thought something was improbable or just a little bit too coincidental, or where I thought he evaded a question about his own motivation for doing something that he did, where anyone else would ordinarily have given more explanation than he gave. And so my tactic there was simply to put that into the book and lay that out for the reader to also judge. And I gave myself the license to speculate, since this is all about speculation and filling in, it's a kind of a narrative risk to say, well, here's what I think was going on, but making sure to demarcate what's history and what has I verified and what is footnoted from what is speculation. Mm.
Well, it's a great, great story, and there is more. Not only is the story of Norfleet told here, but there's also a kind of a larger story about, as the subtitle suggests, the Big Con, history of the Big Con in the United States. So if you want to read more, the book is The Mark Inside. It's published by Knopf, by our guest Amy Reading. And thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, what a pleasure this was. Thank you so much.